Powered through the Alaska Airlines studios.
This is Tom, Jake, and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacy Ross.
The Seattle Seahawks are on pace for their most points scored since 2005. Pretty nice pace there. The question, though, is, Tom brought this up, whether or not this is intentional. Now, obviously, a game plan's always intentional. You plan for your opponent, right? Week one versus Atlanta. You know you're facing a struggling defense, particularly a weak secondary. You're going to throw it all over the field. That's what they did. We came out of that game, Jake, wondering whether or not let Russ cook was going to be the theme of that week or the theme of the season. In weeks two through five, we found out that it was going to be the latter. It was the theme of the season. Russell Wilson right now on pace to break Peyton Manning's total touchdown record for a single season. He's leading the league in touchdowns. He's thrown, I think, what, a pair of interceptions, maybe three. He is just on fire right now, leading the MVP conversation. Seahawks leading the league in points scored after Green Bay's loss to Tampa Bay now. Tom, I'm going to start out with you this time because you think that this has actually forced Pete Carroll's hand.
Yeah, and that number, 33.8 points per game after yesterday's show was over, was like sticking out in my mind. I was like, man, that's a lot of points. Like, why or how have they gotten there? Are they just that good where they're putting up that many points, or is there some reason? Like, are they forced to? And the more I thought about it, like, if the defense were better, if they could limit opposing teams, would they still be scoring at that clip? I think the reason for that output is because their defense allows so many points that they have to continue scoring throughout a game. I mean, they haven't yet been involved in a game where they've had the opportunity to go like ball control, run out the clock, anything like that. They've had to keep on scoring in every game, maybe with the exception of Miami, but even that game got close. If we had a shutdown defense here, they'd probably be scoring less. If you remember back to 2012, 13, 14, that was generally the case, and I'll get back to that in a second. Now, did Pete Carroll, as Stacy brought up, make the decision to let Russ cook because he had to or because he wanted to? I think the answer is actually more of the former. It's partially because he believes in Russ, of course, and partially because the defense just doesn't shut down the opposition. Now, at times in the past, they've played to the pace of the game or to the competition, which sometimes means like playing down to the competition, running the ball, lockdown defense. You know, you beat a bad team 24-10 or something like that. Now, the pace of the game or these games is such that they always have to score as many points as possible. Letting Russ cook is the only way to achieve that. Now, this approach is unlikely to change going forward. And for those of you saying, well, back in 2012 and 13, they blew teams out all the time. Yes, they did sometimes. But if you look closer at the stats, Russ did not have gaudy numbers in those games. Think about the Super Bowl against the Broncos a couple times in 2012 where they put up over 50 points 2 weeks in a row. Russ's numbers weren't big, right? The defense set them up with good field position and scored a lot of points themselves. So the reason why Russ's numbers are big, the wide receivers' numbers are big, and they're scoring so many points is because they're forced to.
Now, Tom, I believe that that might be the case now after 5 weeks of the season, but I don't believe it was the reason why we're witnessing the change offensively here at the beginning of the year. Pete Carroll at the beginning of the year, I promise you, didn't view his defense, view the new additions that he had to this roster and the way that they were playing and competing with this offense through training camp and oftentimes having better days than the offense in training camp, it being a very competitive group. I almost guarantee you he didn't believe that he did believe that his group heading into week one defensively had a tremendous chance of being significantly improved from 2019 and not going backwards. I believe that the reason why you're seeing this change, and I agree, Tom, with everything that you just said, I think from this point moving forward, this is heading into the bye week, doing all the research. They know that this is what they have to do now to win games, unless your defense shows you otherwise. But the reason why they started this way the first 5 weeks is because a couple different factors, I believe. Is one, Russell Wilson. Russell Wilson aggressively advocated for change this offseason. We heard him talk in a way that we hadn't heard him talk before. And I think that he also has continued to display that he is the best quarterback in the game right now. And yes, I said not one of the best quarterback in the game. But the more significant thing, Tom and Stacey, that I believe that's happened over this last offseason, that yes, Russell Wilson has advocated for this, I believe it's also been a reboot to Pete Carroll in terms of being more aggressive. Now, I know that his style of play has been more play great defense and run the ball, but early in his tenure here in Seattle and when he had the Legion of Boom, oftentimes he was very aggressive in situational football. 2014 NFC Championship game, going for the fake field goal for a touchdown. There were oftentimes he would make bold, aggressive calls in any given game in any given season. In 2018 and 2019, you saw Pete Carroll become wildly conservative. And I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that he was just trying to survive, trying to do the best that he could to shorten the game and limit the amount of mistakes possible to give them the best chance to win. And that's what he felt they needed to do. I think reflecting back, however, to the Atlanta Falcons game last year in 2019, I believe has rebooted and led to this new aggressive mindset, Tom, that even when they're ahead, that they're not just trying to stall out and run the ball, that they're actually going to continue to be aggressive. Because if you remember last year in 2019, they were wildly in control of the Atlanta Falcons game. I think they were up 21-3 heading into halftime. Then in the third quarter, they start pulling out starters. They start getting really conservative. And the Atlanta Falcons almost make a comeback in that game. You fast forward to this season, and you even hear Russell Wilson. Here's a different mindset, not just taking it off in a half, but Russell Wilson here in cut number three, Russ is talking about how he's frustrated that this offense stalled just for a couple drives. Tarek, if we could get to cut number three here.
We had three drives in there. I wish we could have had back, really. We kind of got a little stagnant there. We didn't stay hungry just from just how we approached the line of scrimmage and everything else. I think we had those couple penalties there. But other than that, I thought it was a great day. For the first game of the year, a step up like that, guys made plays. We're very confident in what we're doing.
And so that mindset, that mentality, I think is really the change this year. So, yes, they need to play this way because of the way the defense is going. But I don't believe that's the reason why they did this at the beginning and nor why they continue to do so. I believe it's a change in mentality, change in philosophy, you know, pedal to the metal. We are going to put the ball in our best player's hands, and he's going to give us the best chance to win and continue to stay the course and continue to be aggressive. That's why they're 5-0.
This hour of Tom, Jake, and Stacey is brought to you by the Pro Club. Tom Wassel, Jake Heap, Stacey Rost here. I'm going to open up the Vizzy Hard Seltzer text line, 710-710. Here's my question. Did Pete Carroll have his hand forced when it comes to his change in offensive philosophy? Tom says, hey, if the defense wasn't so bad, maybe Pete wouldn't be letting Russ cook. Jake says, well, wait a minute. I think Russell Wilson aggressively advocated for change, and I also think that Pete Carroll is trying to be more aggressive, and that is also a core concept of his own coaching philosophy. So two very different opinions here. Either way, no one's complaining about, you know, Seattle scoring more points. Here's the way I look at it. This sounds like a cop-out, but I think the truth is somewhere in the middle. I think that I don't necessarily agree with Tom as far as week one. I think that they came out with an aggressive game plan against a struggling Atlanta secondary. When I look at weeks two, weeks three, especially, you know, not running the ball nearly as much against New England, after Pete Carroll said, leaving Atlanta, that he wanted to see Carson get more carries, wanted to see Hyde get more carries, that's when I start to think, well, maybe the defense is playing a role here. It's hard not to look at it that way. The points scored this year for Seattle is drastically different. You're looking at more than a touchdown difference in your offensive production from last year. 2019, they averaged 24.7 points per game. Like Tom said, they're 33.8, almost 34 points per game this year, which leads the league. I think that two things can be true, you guys. The first thing is that Pete Carroll believes in adhering to your own philosophy, that there are many kind of cardinal sins to Pete Carroll's program, lack of ball security, not protecting the team, things like that that we already know about. But I think another kind of underrated sin of his program is to forget who you are. It's always his biggest compliment when he talks about other coaches. He knows who he is. They know who they are as a team. It's a very big compliment that Pete Carroll gives other people, because coaching philosophy and kind of a buy-in to a program is so, so important to him. I also believe that Pete Carroll values adaptability. And maybe I wasn't giving him enough credit that he would put adaptability as high up on that totem pole when it came to kind of leaning into what a strength of your team is. I mean, is his hand being forced by the defense? A little bit. If the defense was better, I think they'd try to control the clock a bit more, give Chris Carson some more carries. They wouldn't need to, you know, score a touchdown quickly and get back up there. You saw against Minnesota that 13-0 lead that the Vikings took by halftime. Seattle had to quickly get back in the game. So, no, I don't think you'd be seeing that if the defense wasn't so bad. But I also think that we're underrating, like Jake said, how much Pete Carroll values adaptability.
Yeah, I agree with the adaptability part. And I want to be clear about something. I'm not trying to paint a picture of Pete Carroll before the season saying, okay, I know my defense is bad, therefore I'm going to let Russ cook. This is something that's happening repeatedly, like in games. And it's not like Pete's using those words either. Like he's going with what happens in the games. I mean, I don't believe that, like, take the last drive that the Seahawks put together in the Minnesota game, right? Would they be having that kind of drive late in any given fourth quarter if they were already up 14 points? No. They'd be running out the clock. Like, they wouldn't be slinging it all over the place like that. I mean, I agree, Jake, about wanting to stay aggressive in general, but you still play to the game itself and the game situation. You don't apply that one conviction to all situations and all sets of circumstances. Right. So, again, the offense, every time they take the field, it seems, on every possession, they have to score, is what it's felt like for most of this season. That's not always been the case in the past. Sometimes you have other jobs. Sometimes it's to run out the clock. Sometimes it's just to maintain field position. Go ahead. Go ahead.
I think one example of this is the Dallas Cowboys game. They were up 30-15. They were up 30-15, and that lead evaporated like that. And some of the moments that you would traditionally see this team run the football. You think about the DK Metcalf touchdown at the end to go ahead. It was in third and short. Third and short, and they're dialing up a deep pass down the field to the end zone. That is something where traditionally you would look at Brian Schottenheimer and Brian Schottenheimer and Pete Carroll try to run the football there in those situations, try and get the first down. There was about 4 minutes, 3 minutes left in the game at that point, okay. I believe. And normally you would see them try to run the ball and be able to know that, hey, you have four down. It's four down territory, just like in our show. Hey, we got four downs here. If we run the ball, no worries. If we don't get it, we've got the fourth down to get it. No, they stayed aggressive. They stayed in that aggressive mindset, and they've made some of those calls multiple times this year, which leads you to believe that this is more of a mentality that they've adapted. And so I think that as you're talking about this, I fully agree with you that this group is having to play a style of football that's different. They're being forced to play that way, but I think it already went into their preseason plans, so to speak, as to how they were going about it, if that makes sense.
A couple of responses from the Vizzy Hard Seltzer text line, and that's a good point, Jake. I agree with Jake. That's just the 253. Also, super cute shirt, Stacey. Thank you so much. 480. Where's that? I think Pete looked at his team with John and said, hey, we've hit on offensive talent and we have to give them more opportunities. 253. If Pete Carroll can switch to a plant-based diet, I don't see why people would think he's not capable of dramatic change. A really good point. 253. I don't think his hand was forced. I believe the players had a huge part in the change, which is speaking to Jake's point that Russell Wilson, that perhaps other players too, were kind of advocating, hey, we want more time. Hey, let us do this. Hey, let us take chances. And speaking to that point, I lost the text on here, but someone texting in, hey, what if that aggressive mindset started with the Philly playoff game, that deep shot to DK for the win? Pretty good points. I like this. You guys are doing a good job. All right, let's get back to this conversation a little bit later. I love it. For right now, let's get to three questions.
It's time for three questions.
Can't wait for it.
Every day at 12 after 12, Tom Wassel's burning questions for Jake Heaps and Stacey Ross.
Enough with the we got to protect the kids nonsense.
Nobody agrees with me on the text here, really? Jeez.
I said I kind of agree with you.
I mean, really? You guys don't think that the defense, not you, but nobody out there thinks because the defense is so bad and giving up so many points that the offense, that's forced the offense to score so many
there
points?
There might be someone that agrees with you. No, I'm sure there's people that agree that aren't texting in. That's what I tell myself when I say opinions, Tom. There are probably tens of thousands of people that agree with me and think I'm brilliant. They just aren't texting in.
I think they don't like the fact that I'm saying it. That's what it is.
Oh, Tom, I feel that way a lot.
No, I don't think so, Tom. I think that this is part of the conversation of was this an adjustment that they've made mid-season? Was this part of the plan? Because I agree with you after 5 weeks of the season that they have to do this. That they are, even if they wanted to go backwards, they don't really have the luxury of doing so. I just believe that this was part of the plan for offensively for them to be this high-powered, high-octane offense from the beginning. It's worked out for them. And this defense, I think, is underwhelmingly has not performed to any expectation that Pete Carroll's had.
503 says, I agree with you, Tom. And then someone else texted in and said, Tom, if it helps, I think you look cute today, too. All right, question one.
Question one. Sorry, I had to wallow in victimhood.
That's okay.
All right, by adding a big-time receiver, as some have requested, whether it's Julio Jones or whoever, what's your expectation for improvement in terms of points per game? So we're at 33.8 right now. If we had another big-time wide receiver here, then what's your expectation, Jake?
My expectation is that they stay the same. The reason why you make this change or you add a big weapon is not necessarily thinking, oh, we're going to be 33 points per game, which is number one in the NFL, and we're going to skyrocket that to 40 points per game. No, what it would do is to ensure and help you stay at that level. So when you start to play tougher opponents like the 49ers and the Rams and the Cardinals, you don't miss a beat because you're constantly putting a defense in really bad situations. They have to make a decision. Pick your poison. All right, you're going to try and double team somebody here. You're going to leave a one-on-one matchup over here that we highly would take advantage of, right? So, again, I think that that's more of the reason why you would do that. Even if you had huge defensive holes, I think they need to add to the defense, but I don't think it would change expectations. It just allows you to stay at the top of your game.
Question two.
Number two.
If Clayton Kershaw loses, he's defective. If he wins, he's the best pitcher that ever lived. It seems like every single time he wins or loses, there's this drastic shift in the way his legacy is perceived. Guys, why is that? And you can take other athletes and use them as examples if you wish, but certainly we've seen it with Kershaw over the course of his playoff career. What do you think, Stacey?
I think that all of our heroes need a fatal flaw. We need to see it as people. It's really unfair when they don't have one. And it's also unfair to them because sometimes that narrative is totally wrong, or that narrative is based on a couple appearances because it's so incredibly difficult to get to the MLB postseason. I look at Peyton Manning as being one example in the NFL. This guy will constantly lead you to you know, one of the best regular season records, and then somehow he'll choke in the postseason. Was that always fair? No, absolutely not. Peyton Manning, one of the best quarterbacks to ever play the game, and that includes several postseason appearances. But, I mean, the bar is so high when you are that good in a regular season or when you are one of the best ever at your position that the second you fall below it, people will rail on you and people will say, there it is. That's the fatal flaw of our hero. And people don't want to let that go because it also makes you more human to them.
Well, the unfortunate reality, though, for Clayton Kershaw is as decorated as his career has been, he's had a history of blowing games in the postseason. And so that narrative, that narrative hasn't just come out of thin air. It hasn't come out of one performance. It's come out of multiple performances. So what has ended up happening is you talk about this hero and this fatal flaw, you end up rooting for the hero to overcome the fatal flaw, right? Just like in any movie. So I was really happy to see Clayton Kershaw absolutely dealing in this World Series performance here in Game 1 and to be able to alleviate some of that pressure off of him. And you know that he feels it. He knows about it. He knows what people are talking about. And so a really, really nice moment for Clayton Kershaw, who is a Hall of Famer, who is one of the best pitchers of all time. Very deserving.
Next.
Number 3.
Do you guys think there's any pressure on Russell Wilson, or is he just so good that he's above criticism? Like, if they don't end up making the playoffs or whatever, will he shoulder any of that blame, Stacey?
Not as much as you'd expect a quarterback to shoulder. I go back to Super Bowl 49. It is weird that in the final minute of that game, a quarterback threw an interception at the goal line, and our conversations for years since then have been around, did Pete Carroll lose them that game? Did Pete Carroll make the worst call in Super Bowl history? Is this the worst moment in Seattle's history? Could Ricardo Lockett have made that catch? You know what I mean? It's never focused on, did Russell Wilson make a bad play? Now, you could look at it and you can say, look, Lockett should have been in a different place, or maybe that is a bad call or whatever. I know why you'd make the argument that that's not on Russell Wilson, but I think for the most part, Russell Wilson is a very well-liked player by fans and one that does escape some criticism. Now, the flip side of that is that he also has to do so much to be considered one of the best quarterbacks ever, right? He will have to be perfect for the rest of this season to be in an MVP conversation that Patrick Mahomes, not having his best season, is currently in right now.
I believe there's pressure on Russell Wilson, no question. Look at on our own radio station. It almost feels like any game now, you're going to hear from Mike Salk and Jim Moore how letting Russ cook is going to be the demise of this team. And see, I told you so. And even through the contract negotiations, is Russell Wilson the guy that you're willing to give this kind of money to towards? I think that at this point, Russell Wilson deserves a lot of pressure on him because this is his team. This is his moment. This is his opportunity to show that if the ball is in my hands, good things are going to happen, as you have advocated for many years now. Now, is he going to be the ultimate reason why they didn't win games? No, I don't think so. I think we've already been talking about this defense, right? Tom's saying that this defense has forced their hand to play this style of game. So that's going to be one thing that I think people will look to first before they criticize Russell Wilson at this point, because he is that good.
All right, don't forget, if you missed the show, you can listen to it via the 710 Sports app powered by Dubin Law Group. We'll ask Mike Salk this question. He joins us next on Tom, Jake, and Stacey.
You're listening to Tom, Jake, and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacey Rost.
Welcome back into Tom, Jake, and Stacey. Mike Salk joining us now, brought to you by Jafco Plumbing and Sewer. Mike, how are you?
I'm good, Stacey.
Great.
How are we doing?
We're great, Mike. Look, this has nothing to do with me doing a really thick Australian accent during the break. That's not what this is at all. So if that's your question and that's the reason that I'm messing up right now, that's the answer is nope. Definitely not. Mike, we were talking about we were talking about whether or not Pete Carroll had his hand forced with letting Russ cook. I actually, no, I don't necessarily agree with Tom on this one, but he makes a really good point. So Tom said, would we be seeing Russell Wilson in this offense being as powerful as they are right now if the defense wasn't so bad? Like, did Pete Carroll kind of make his own bed as far as this change in offensive philosophy? Do you agree?
Well, I think there's sort of a couple different questions in there. Let me see if I can parse it out. I mean, the first thing is, do I think Pete had his hand forced? Yes, I do. I don't believe that this is the style of football that Pete Carroll, in his heart, would prefer to play. I think Pete watches the Tennessee Titans and he's jealous. I think that's what he wants out of a football team, and that's sort of the style that he would prefer his team play. So I do think that his hand is forced. I'm not saying that Pete's a puppet. I'm not saying that, you know, he's like a hostage being sent out there to read his lines in front of the camera every week. But I don't think that this is ideal for him, and I think it's challenging for him every week to watch his team kind of go out there and play a style that is just not indicative of what Pete chooses. Now, did he make his own bed? Yeah, I think that some of that is absolutely true. I think they have made quite a bit of their own bed. You got some really tough drafts, especially on the defensive side of the ball. Some personnel decisions that have been problematic and have not paid dividends for them. I know Brock this week has been all over the fact that the Seahawks had every opportunity, if they'd wanted to draft Buda Baker, who looks like a star. And if you had done that instead of Malik McDowell, which we all know where that went, where could you be right now with a player like that on the back end and not having to go through the Tedrick Thompson, Leno Hill disaster and not having to give up two first-round picks to bring in a guy like Jamal Adams? You'd be in a completely different spot. And that's just one move and one decision, forgetting about all of the others that come across the way. I mean, the decision to sign Bobby Wagner to a gigantic contract, the decision to trade Frank Clark, which, by the way, I was in favor of at the time, but you look at it now and you see what's happened with Clowney and where your pass rush is, and you can certainly now start to raise some questions about it. So, yeah, I think their hand was forced partially because of Russ and his desire to play a different style. And also very much from what you just said in terms of their defense just not playing well enough to give them any other options.
Yeah, Salk, I definitely feel like at this point, after 5 weeks, you look at the bye week, Pete Carroll is certainly looking at this defense and going, well, even if I wanted to go back, I really can't, right? But you see this style and the way that they're playing, and I think you outlined greatly as to why and how they got here with this offense. But also, I think it's a reboot for Pete. I think it's a reboot for him to be aggressive. And I know that's kind of weird in the sense of his philosophy to play great defense and to run the football. But aggressiveness in his decision-making, aggressiveness in wanting to roll the dice and go for it. He's certainly done that multiple times, to your chagrin, in third and short situations. They passed the ball plenty of times in those. Do you think that this is an overall, do you think this is more of a Russell Shoddy situation, or do you think Pete's given his full blessing to say, hey, look, we need to be aggressive. We need to go for it. The last 2 years, I've been a little bit conservative and we need to change.
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I do think that Pete, you know, for all of his conversation, all of his desire to be a balanced football team, to run the ball, to play defense, he is aggressive by nature. And I remember him years ago referring to it as being hormonal. That was his phrase, where he just kind of loses it and, you know, takes over. And the next thing you know, he's going for it on a fourth down where maybe he shouldn't, or throwing the ball deep where maybe they just needed a yard or two. I mean, Pete does have that streak in him where every once in a while he just does something a little bit offbeat. I think that's probably necessary now, right? I mean, you don't have the defense to bail you out over and over again. You can't just play to them. You've got to take some chances now to try to help them be in the best position possible. So, yeah, look, it in some ways you're getting back to some of what makes Pete great, and I'm sure he does like that, the ability to be aggressive, but I still think he looks at this team and just sees it as unrecognizable for a Pete Carroll football team.
Do you think it's strange at all that after Clayton Kershaw pitches poorly in a playoff game, there's this huge pendulum swing to say, like, oh, he's great, but he's got this huge weakness and the playoffs aren't his thing. And then he pitches a great game and his legacy gets solidified the other way. Have you found that? And if and why do you think that is, if so?
Well, I'm trying to think if there's another player who's had his postseason legacy swing back and forth more and analyzed more than Clayton Kershaw. I mean, like, you've got a couple of postseason gods that you just sort of assume everything they do is great, and that's going to be the history. I mean, David Ortiz and Derek Jeter in our lifetime, Tom, are probably the two you'd point to more than anyone else, although certainly there are others. They are postseason heroes, and there really wasn't anything they could do to turn that legacy against them. But how many guys have had it go back and forth and swing around and be as analyzed as Kershaw? He's in the playoffs virtually every single year. He has had his struggles at times, but you look at it and say when he hasn't been forced to pitch on short rest or out of the bullpen, he's actually been really effective as a starting pitcher in the postseason. So, look, the guy is one of the best in the game. He's had, I don't think it's joking. I think he's actually had some bad luck in playoff starts. But it is also fair to look at and say, all right, the numbers aren't quite what they are during the regular season. He's a great pitcher, and I think he showed it once again last night.
So do you think that reputation is, for the most part, unearned? With
no,
context.
I think he's done some to earn it. I think that the book hasn't been written on Kershaw yet. I mean, how many more playoff appearances and would you expect from Kershaw? I mean, he might be in the playoffs four more times before this career is over. Like, there's a long book to be written there.
Salk, how fun is it to watch Kyler Murray and Russell Wilson play against each other?
I think it's going to be a blast. I mean, it's almost a taste of your own medicine, right? After watching Russ just frustrate you know, frustrate other teams and laughing to yourself as Viking fans have been among the most tortured by Russell. And you just sort of laugh when they get frustrated, like, sheesh, we have Kirk Cousins and you have that? This is just unfair. I mean, Kyler Murray is not Russell Wilson. He's not as accurate, I don't believe. And, he's certainly not the pocket passer yet that Russell is right now. But he's faster. He's more maneuverable. I mean, he gets out of situations as well, or I would probably say better than Russ. And at this stage in their careers, you know, where they're both at right now, his ability to get down the field with his legs is vastly superior to what Russ's is. So, yeah, I think it's absolutely a taste of your own medicine. The difference is, you know, Russell's just better overall. He's got the command of his offense. He's got the, I think probably a better roster than Arizona does. He's got DK Metcalf. I mean, Russ has some advantages. But I think there's going to be a battle for the next few years between these two guys in the NFC West.
Now, you can normally hear Mike on the weekly Brock and Salk podcast. New episodes drop Tuesday night. But Mike had to take a much-deserved vacation from his one-hour-a-week podcast. Mike, we really, really hope you enjoy the rest of your week.
thanks, guys. Talk
no
to you tomorrow.
Problem. Bye, Mike. You can also hear Mike every single day at 12:30 right here on Tom, Jake, and Stacey. Jake brought up a really interesting question yesterday, you guys. Has Russell Wilson paved the way for Kyler Murray? And I think we'd all answer yes, but in what ways has he? And in what ways has the league not changed? We're going to take a look at that next on Tom, Jake, and Stacey.
You're listening to Tom, Jake, and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacey Rost.
Welcome back into Tom, Jake, and Stacey. Tarek, I'm really upset about this music. I'm not going to talk about it right now. What is this even?
It's Gary Newman.
I've specifically requested Beyonce for every single intro.
Very similar.
Oh, my God. We're going to play a little bit of a game. It's a very, very quick one. Jake and Tom, I'm going to read you guys two scouting reports. One is about Russell Wilson. One is about Kyler Murray. I want you to guess which is which. Are you ready?
Ready. Who's guessing first?
You guys,
are we both guessing
you're
at the
both
same
guessing.
Time?
You're both guessing because I'm going to read you guys one first. Okay.
Okay.
Here's the first one. Extremely short and underweight for typical quarterbacks. He could have durability issues in the NFL. He's too short to execute three-step drop-back passing in the NFL, and not wildly inaccurate, but misses some throws, especially high. Recall is just average.
Russell.
Yeah, that seems very harsh for I think they would lighten up their the number one pick. But however, Kyler Murray did have a smaller frame than Russell, so I'm gonna say Kyler Murray.
Okay,
I'm gonna say Kyler Murray.
I'm gonna read the next one.
Well, what am I
gonna... No. I'm gonna read the next one because I want to see if you want to change your mind, Tommy. Okay.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Despite his diminutive size, he can actually throw the ball with power. Where he struggled a bit was with throws downfield. He showed good mechanics to get rid of the ball quickly and a very strong arm to make every NFL throw without a problem, but teams can't ignore his height and lack of consistency as a pocket passer. He likely won't be drafted because his performance this week showed that he will be, at best, a backup quarterback in the NFL. At his height, teams will have concerns whether or not he can see to make the throws at the next level. If he were 3 inches taller, there would be a debate at the top of the draft as to where he fits in, but look for teams to take a flyer on him in late rounds and see if he can develop and outplay his size.
Russ.
It's Russell Wilson.
Russell.
Here's the other part of that. Russell Wilson is a superb athlete, but he's very inconsistent as a passer. He's shorter than Kellen Moore, who lasted a long time, and several of his passes tend to sail high. Those passes will turn into interceptions at the next level. When he's rolling out, his accuracy also leaves a lot to be desired. Now, you'll notice from reading both of these that the Kyler Murray one, which was first, the first one was Kyler Murray. That was the negative part of his overall scouting report. For the most part, Kyler Murray, who they did say the biggest con was that he's extremely short and thinner framed, underweight. He had many positives. Russell Wilson was like not universally panned by any means, but his cons were much greater. And I think, Jake, that what you mentioned during our show prep is correct. That what you see when you look at Russell Wilson's 2012 scouting report compared to Kyler Murray's, who at times in his own scouting reports was compared to Russell Wilson, is that people in general see a bit more possibility, a bit more potential from quarterbacks who are undersized or shorter than traditional pocket passers. And you also see a little bit more of a belief that, like, maybe he can play in the pocket, maybe he can kill you with his legs. So overall, Kyler Murray's scouting reports and, you know, part of that's where he played, but we're more positive. And unsurprisingly, he was a much earlier draft pick.
Right. And because of Russell Wilson, Kyler Murray sits in that situation. If Russell Wilson had not come along, Kyler Murray would probably be the Russell Wilson we see today. In the sense that you're a third to fourth round pick, there's a lot of skepticism of a player who can play at with that size and with an unorthodox style. Because a lot of the NFL still at that point, I'll just take you back, not just Russell Wilson and Kyler Murray, their style being a near exact reflection of each other at that age of their career, in the first, second year of their career. But it has evolved the quarterback position at the NFL level. The way quarterbacks are trained now versus 10 years ago has drastically changed. And being a coach now versus being one of those quarterbacks that was training and getting ready to be my best, 10 plus years ago, everything was focused on your drops and focusing on the pocket and focusing on your mechanics and things like that. And where this has evolved 10 years from, 10 years today is everything. Yes, those same things are valued. But it's how can you play in chaos? How can you manipulate the pocket with your movement and being able to throw on the run and throw, off balance and off platform? These are things that Russell Wilson has displayed and has had tremendous success with in 9 seasons. And Kyler Murray also shows those same traits. And you can look across the NFL now and see multiple quarterbacks that have that unique ability.
In those evaluations, Stacey, was one of the ones of Russell that he was inaccurate? Was that said about him in any of them?
Some of them. I think they just said he was inconsistent. They didn't say he was inaccurate. They just said his passes tend to sail high, and they questioned whether he could be accurate from the pocket.
Okay, so let's ask about that for a second. Is that a misevaluation? In other words, this person looked at the film and just didn't look close enough, or was the analysis correct, But for whatever reason, that analysis didn't translate to the NFL game. Something about the NFL game just made him better.
I think that it's a mix of both. I think that Russell Wilson has continued to improve every single year of both his college and NFL careers. Russell Wilson today is significantly better than he was in college, but Russell Wilson in college was also much better than he is in these scouting reports. So I think part of it's true, Tom. I think that what I also notice with a lot of these, and there are areas where the NFL has advanced. I think that the NFL is more open-minded about the traits that quarterbacks can have and still be successful, that shorter quarterbacks can still be successful. It'll be more difficult, but it's possible. That quarterbacks who are mobile can be durable over the course of their career or can adapt and become more pocket passers. In that way, the league has evolved. One way that I think the league is still a bit backwards is that black quarterbacks are often compared to black quarterbacks. And I think that with that comes a stigma of being more athletic, less accurate, and usually like football IQ is questioned. It's like, it's very racist without realizing it's racist, I think. But I think that that's why things like Russell Wilson's accuracy is questioned, because he's not being compared to Aaron Rodgers, who he looks more like now. He's being compared to like Michael Vick, to McNair, to guys. When he came in, people were like, oh, he's just RG3. He's being compared to other quarterbacks, on average, black, like usually other black quarterbacks, who he may not actually share a ton in common with. But because of that, some of, you know, RG3's accuracy issues or whatever might also be linked to Russell Wilson, even though there aren't nearly as many questions there.
I think that sometimes you have that. I think, Tom, it's a great question, because a lot of it, as Stacey outlined, goes into what you already previously have deemed Russell Wilson, right? What do you think of height? What do you think of a black quarterback? What do you think of, you know, this, that, and the other? And the same could be, you know, said for a 6'6", you know, tall quarterback who can't really move, right? Mm-hmm. There's just inherently, there's a stereotype that goes along with certain attributes or physical traits that these guys have. And so do some of these, I think with some guys, some of their blemishes get overlooked more than others. And obviously in Russell Wilson's case, when he was coming through the draft, his blemishes were heightened because people just simply didn't believe that at that height and with his style of play that it could translate into the NFL. So they were more harsher than they are at Kyler Murray 8 years later, when they've seen that Russell Wilson and his style can succeed at a very, very high level. They tend to have a different perspective, and that evaluation changes and those critiques are not as drastic.
It's a good question, though, Tom, because I think that, as you point out, like, in some ways, the NFL has changed. And then there are also things that may not have anything to do with that. You look at Kyler Murray and Patrick Mahomes. They went into completely different situations than Russell Wilson did. So that's also another reason for the way that we see those two quarterbacks versus Wilson early on in his career.
Yeah, and what they're asked to do. I mean, Kyler Murray and Russell Wilson are probably, their playing styles are probably more similar right now in 2020. It's just that Kyler Murray's being asked to do something early on in his career that Russell wasn't asked to do early on. One's a veteran, one's a rookie. They're being asked to do different things. And that's a result of, you know, where they were drafted and where they're and how their teams were built and when too. So, you know, everybody has a different assignment in life. But it is interesting that, all that said, their styles are pretty similar right now, except Kyler's a better runner because he's got younger legs.
Yeah. We're going to get back to this conversation coming up in the halftime show at 1:30, and we'll probably touch on it a little bit later in the show. But first, what does the return of Michael Kendricks mean for this Seahawks team? When are we going to see Jamal Adams? We've got all kinds of questions, and we're going to ask Bob Condotta of the Seattle Times. That's next on Tom, Jake, and Stacey.